Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the don't nearly view system deal. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
With a new podcast every day of the Premier League season, this is Football Social Daily.
Howdy, welcome to Football Social Daily, your daily Premier League podcast. It's Friday, but there is no coasting into the weekend here because there is so much going on in the world of Premier League football today. Not only were the 10 Premier League teams in action last night with West Ham's European journey hitting the buffers and the issues at Leeds United becoming even more apparent than they already were. We're going to talk about those things very shortly on Football Social Daily. But we also need to peer ahead into the weekend. There's our three-game roundup of the tastiest ties from the weekend's action as we make our predictions with Who Knows Wins and your chance to win £6,000. We'll get onto that shortly. And we've got a small matter of Chelsea Football Club being seized by the UK government as sanctions against Vladimir Putin and his cronies continues. We've got a proper expert to talk us through that shortly as well. Adding their non-expert views into the mix today, however, we've got Niall McCorn and Marley Anderson. How are we doing, boys?
I'm good. Morning, boys. And steady on, Jim, because actually I was thinking about yesterday's podcast and what you were saying about the games that took place last night, and you were pretty much spot on with all of them.
That's like Hayley's comment, that, when it comes around every 30 years. I get something right. Amazing stuff. Right, so we're going to kick off with the situation at Chelsea. A hugely complex situation right now. As it stands, the club as an asset of Roman Abramovich has been seized by the UK government, and Abramovich will be prevented from making any profits from its running. This means the club can play games, players and staff can be played, but it also means no more tickets can be sold for those games, and the sale of the club that was mooted a few weeks ago has been put on ice as well. Hopefully to answer some of our and some of your questions as to what is, as I say, a hugely complex situation for Chelsea Football Club, we've got Kieran Maguire from the brilliant Price of Football podcast, an excellent football business podcast. How are you, Kieran?
I'm good. Another quiet day in the world of football finance awaits.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty remarkable situation we see at Chelsea Football Club at the moment. We proved on yesterday's podcast that it's really difficult to grasp exactly what's going on. But I think the question that most Chelsea fans are probably asking at the moment is exactly how worried should they be about the future of their football club?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd probably put it no more than a 3 or a 4. And the reason for that is that whilst Roman Abramovich's assets have been frozen, the government has granted a special licence to allow Chelsea to trade. I think there's two issues on the back of that. What money is coming in and what money is going out? We know in terms of the wage bill, it's around about £28 million a month. That's probably going to go out in the next 2.5-3 weeks. I think that's going to be the first focus of concern. We don't know how much money the club's got in the bank account or whether the Premier League will advance some of the money which is due from the remaining TV deals to cover the rest of the season to allow it to pay the wages.
I mean, there's two different scenarios, I guess, two different questions. One is the future of Chelsea Football Club as a football club, as an entity. The other is what happens with Chelsea Football Club in terms of their success. As it stands right now, my assumption is that they're not allowed to sign any players, obviously. But how does that work with contract renewals and the likes of Anthony Rudiger, whose contract's up very soon? Could they find themselves potentially in a situation, if this scenario drags on for 6, 12, 24 months, where their playing staff is just getting smaller and smaller and smaller because contracts are expiring and they're unable to bring new players in.
That is a potential issue, but if you take a look at the small print of the government licence, it expires on the 31st of May. And the club has already made representations to the government to try to flex some of the terms of the contract. For example, in terms of travel expenses to matches, that is limited to £20,000. Now, whilst that, you know, that would just about cover a full tank these days, from the perspective of the club, they would be normally chartering flights especially for Champions League matches. That could be a challenge. So there could be some flexibility there. They're limited to £500,000 a match in terms of match day overheads. And all of this is to try to protect the club, or to try to protect the government's position in the sense, could Roman Abramovich attempt to game the system by saying, well, I'll arrange a flight for Chelsea and it's going to cost £1 million a match. So I think the government is taking a cautious approach. It will be in continued negotiations with the club. In terms of the sale of Chelsea Football Club, which is another concern, again, officially under the licence terms, that cannot go ahead, but the government will be practical and pragmatic and find a workaround, such as overseeing the sale and ensuring that any gross proceeds or proceeds less agents fees and so on that it approves of go to an account that can't be accessed by Roman Abramovich.
I mean, the government very handily gave Roman Abramovich a good 2 weeks heads up that they were going to be seizing his assets pretty much, and he managed to move a lot of his finance out of the country. But the Chelsea Football Club was a little bit more of a challenge. It's been for sale for 2 weeks. There were some rumours about potential takeovers. If the government do allow a sale, and like you say, they're going to be pragmatic with their approach here, is it an attractive proposition at the moment? Is it a good business call for an investor? Or is it even a better potential purchase than it was 2 weeks ago because it could be a cheaper option?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It could now be classified as a distressed asset. And normally you'd expect a discount under those circumstances. So prospective owners, they will not see what happened to Roman Abramovich yesterday as being too high a hurdle for them to overcome. And it could work in their benefit. Is Chelsea an attractive financial proposition? Well, if you're going to run it in the same way as Roman Abramovich has done, which was very much as a trophy asset, as a glorified executive toy that he used to have fun with himself, then you'd certainly say no. Chelsea has lost more money than any other club in the history of the Premier League, more than £900 million since 1992. So that again would perhaps encourage people to reduce the price they're prepared to pay. But if they decide to run it on under more sensible business lines, and we've seen new owners come in at the likes of Liverpool who have operated on a break-even basis, then it all of a sudden changes tack. I would imagine that given Chelsea's location, it's in London, it's in the right part of London, it's got all of those trophies to effectively inherit from a history and heritage point of view, then there's going to be a lot of people still interested.
Kieran, in terms of selling the club, we can obviously talk about the government allowing people to inquire about buying the club, but I guess for me it's a far more Spartan question, which is, what is the value of Chelsea at the moment? You mentioned how it might be a distressed asset, but who's setting the price here? Because obviously we know Abramovich wanted £3 billion, but if the club's sold, he's the 100% majority stakeholder. He's not going to be able to see any of those profits due to the sanctions that have been imposed by the government. So in terms of a potential sale, let's say we do see Chelsea sold before that expiry of the license on the 31st of May, who's setting the price? Is it the government? Will there be an independent regulator who values the club? That's what's interesting me.
Well, yes, I think exactly, Niall, that the £3 billion, which was being touted around, and I'm sure we've spoken to the same sources as to where that price originally came from. To me, looking at it from a financial modelling, from a nerd perspective, it was always top heavy. Because not only is it going to cost you, if you're paying £3 billion, you're acquiring Stamford Bridge, and Stamford Bridge is a problem because it's got a capacity of 41,000. It is looking a little bit tired in places. Roman Abramovich had originally spoken about moving to a bigger, more modern stadium, and Chelsea have been overtaken. They've been overtaken in London itself. We have Arsenal, Spurs and West Ham all playing in 60,000 capacity stadiums. If you take a look at the match day revenues that Chelsea are earning, realistically, they're probably going to generate £30 to £40 million a season less than Spurs, who have invested heavily. So you'd have the construction costs of at least another £1 billion, possibly more, to add on to the purchase price if you want to carry Chelsea forwards. So I don't think the asking price was particularly realistic. I think they were trying to froth up interest from rich people to hold them off against one another. Then when it comes to the sale proceeds, Roman Abramovich had put out a press release to say, and here I think the wording requires a degree of caution, the net proceeds, not defined, would be given to the victims of the conflict, victims not defined. I think there was caution there, but the government can certainly bring in rules. And remember, no financial institution is going to want to be tainted by getting involved in this, where the government comes out of this unhappy, because the financial institution risks going on a list of undesirables itself.
How much culpability do you think that the Premier League needs to take for the situation around Chelsea? Because reports claim that only 15 minutes before the announcement was made public, that was when the Premier League found out. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way towards the Premier League, but in terms of what we see with the ownership in the Premier League at the moment, we're only one political problem or financial meltdown away from a club going out of business. We've seen that here in a really high-profile case with Chelsea. We know about the owners at Manchester City and Newcastle, which we've spoken about on this podcast before. So it feels almost like we're in quite a precarious situation where it only takes one flashpoint somewhere else in the world to trigger problems for English football here.
Well, you're absolutely right. And this is a function of self-regulation. Under the rules of the Premier League, the owners and directors test is effectively dictated by a minimum of 14 people voting for an individual proposal. Now, if you are the owner of a football club, do you want to change the rules in such a way that it's going to make it more difficult for you to sell your club? So that's why perhaps the rules, when they have been observed, when they have been subject to scrutiny, do appear relatively relaxed in the eyes of some, because it's not in the interests of individual owners to have more to have rules which are more difficult to comply with, because that reduces the pool of people who are potentially going to buy your football club. If we take a look at Tracy Crouch's proposals, which was to take away that ability from effectively owners determining the decisions with regards to who can control a football club and bring it in under the realm of an independent organisation, we could introduce a moral, ethical, human rights-based approach, although the football industry will claim, why are you doing this to us? We're one of the most successful industries in the UK. You're not doing it to the armaments industry. You're not doing it to the automobile industry. You're not doing it to exports of alcohol and cigarettes and other products. So we feel that we are being expected to live to a higher standard than other industries in the UK.
Kieran, just on the in the last couple of days, we've seen three UK and potentially Nike like distancing themselves from Chelsea, and we've seen it in recent times with West Ham and Kurt Zouma. They lost a lot of sponsorship and things like that. Chelsea's sponsors are sort of lining up to sort of get away from the sinking ship type of thing. Where do Chelsea go from here to rectify that? Because assuming they all leave, attracting new sponsors to a club with this cloud hanging over them is something that would not be very straightforward.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If Chelsea continue to be associated with Roman Abramovich and until the club finds new owners, no sponsor is going to step forwards, because why do sponsors get involved with football clubs in the first place? It's because the football club provides a billboard for the brand of the sponsor. Now, if the football club is tainted through association with the owner, then the sponsor indirectly becomes tainted. And people will say, well, you know, three, are you indirectly supporting Roman Abramovich and therefore Vladimir Putin in terms of what he is doing in terms of the invasion and the destruction that's taking place in Ukraine? There's no sponsor that's going to be willing to pay for that. So whilst we're in a state of indeterminate position with regards to the ownership of Chelsea, it can only be bad news from a commercial perspective.
Is this completely unprecedented, the situation we're seeing here? I don't think something similar has happened in UK football. I might be wrong, but is there something in world football we can look to and go kind of, okay, this is how this is panning out?
No, there hasn't been. I mean, the only thing we can perhaps look at is the drawn out issues in relation to the takeover of Newcastle United, and that has still left some people unhappy in terms of a new owner coming in who some people claim has a direct association with the government, although as far as the Premier League is concerned, there are suitable steps of separation. So that's probably the closest thing we took. And remember, that took 3 years to resolve.
Finish with a bit of positivity for us, Kieran, because I think for Chelsea fans, they're going to be pretty miserable after the last couple of days of news. What's the best case scenario that Chelsea fans can hope for now?
Right. Best case scenario is that it's in the interests of the government, the Premier League, Roman Abramovich and Chelsea Football Club for a new owner to be found, and that the proceeds of the sale of the club are kept away from Roman Abramovich. That is not an insurmountable problem. So Richard Masters has said that the quickest deal that's ever gone through in the history of the Premier League is 10 days. Could we be talking about new owners of Chelsea at the end of the month? I think that could be challenging because we are talking of a potential purchase price of $1.5 to $2 billion is more realistic than $3 billion, that can go through. And when there's monies around, I can assure you, accountants, lawyers, and investment bankers are capable of working 24 hours a day, and they'll certainly be charging you for 24 hours a day, even if they're not doing the work, in order to get the deal over the line. And also from a new owner's point of view, in respect of Marley's comment, that they will want to be in situ as quickly as possible because they've got to repair reputations. They've got to go forwards and say to three, look, you're now acquiring Chelsea, and it's Joe Schmo from Louisiana is in charge, and I'm not connected to Vladimir Putin, and we go forward with more guaranteed revenues.
Kieran, as always, fascinating to talk to you. I'm sure there's plenty more chat about this Chelsea issue and the other parts of the world of football business on your podcast, Price of Football with Kevin Day. It's always a fascinating listen. So appreciate your time today on Football Social Daily.
Thanks very much for the invite, chaps.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.
Sports Social, now on the Sports Social Podcast Network.
This is Pedro from the Arsenal Opinion Podcast, and I am hyped about the title running. Can Arsenal pit Pep and Klopp? Will our young squad be described as mentality monsters? Is Mikel Arteta truly a generational saucy manager? Come and join us on the Arsenal Opinion Podcast to follow the boys on this historic 2024 Premier League title run-in and hear analysis of the games, the hottest transfer rumours, the Arsenal culture and the business of football. 3 times a week exclusively on the Sports Social Podcast Network. Search the Arsenal Opinion now and come and join the fun.
Football's Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Welcome back to Football Social Daily. Loads of football on last night. 10 Premier League teams in action, 4 Premier League games. So there's a lot to get through. So I've got a bit of an idea of how we're going to get through this quickly. We're going to do some one-line roundups. So we're going to rattle through last night's games in turn. And Niall and Marley are going to tell us their thoughts on those games, but just one comment. No arguments, no monologues, just kind of a little summary of how that game went. Are you okay with this, boys?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's have
a
go.
I want to do a 2,000-word review on how we made it nine unbeaten. So Marley, you two will do your lines. I'll do the monologue.
I know your work ethic. You are not doing a 2,000-word review. You're doing a meme. 140 characters. Right, let's crack on with this. We've got loads to get through, like I said. Let's start with Norwich City 1, Chelsea 3, Niall.
Well, yesterday on the podcast, we were reacting to the news that Chelsea had been sanctioned by the UK government and that the asset that is Chelsea Football Club was frozen due to the fact that they were owned by Roman Abramovich. And obviously, we've just heard from Kieran about some of the fallout on that, as well as the discussions we had yesterday. Obviously, it came on a match day. The announcement was the morning of the game last night between Norwich and Chelsea at Carrow Road. And I was wondering whether this would affect the players and whether that would give Norwich their best possible chance of reversing the result against Chelsea, which they suffered earlier on in the season, their heaviest defeat of the campaign, where they got beaten 7-0 back in October, November at Stamford Bridge. Wasn't the case. 3 minutes on the clock, Trevo Chalobah scores. I was completely wrong. And yesterday you said, Jim, that sometimes these moments of adversity can actually galvanise a group of players. And I've seen evidence of that in the past, but it didn't feel quite like that was going to happen. It felt like a very dark day for Chelsea yesterday and their fans. There was a lot of sort of gloominess around the club, but that wasn't on display when it comes to the players. I know Norwich is probably the easiest opponent you could handpick out of the Premier League in terms of someone you want to face when you're not really in the best frame of mind. But it didn't take Chelsea long to hit their straps. 3 minutes, as I say. They were 2-0 up, I think, inside the first half. Tiemu Pukki did score a penalty to bring Norwich back into it, but Kai Havertz with a really accomplished finish. And Chelsea, it was almost as if they carried on where they had left off. And a week on from when Abramovich announced on the match day against Luton in the FA Cup, well, that was a bit more of a struggle, Chelsea against Luton, than it was Chelsea against Norwich last night. So we have to remember it's the same players that Chelsea have got. It's the same manager that Chelsea have got at the moment. The same goals are still there to win the Champions League, win the FA Cup and finish in the top four. And that showed no signs of changing last night. So routine for Chelsea, despite all of the stuff going on around them.
I did like Thomas Tuchel's comments after the game as well, saying, as long as we've got some blue shirts, as long as we've got a team bus, we're still Chelsea Football Club. And it's Newcastle next for Chelsea. They played Southampton last night. Another win for the Magpies. Marley, it was Southampton 1, it was Newcastle 2.
It was, yes. It was Newcastle 2, Southampton 1. Ralph Hasenhüttl in a little puddle of his own tears.
And I was an honorary Magpie last night.
Oh, man. Yeah, it was mint. I said that we're sort of looking forward to the game and in a good moment, of course, for obvious reasons. But yeah, I mean, it culminated into a win. We've got a really good record against Southampton. Yeah, I think they beat us once in the last 10 games now. So they usually don't beat us. And after getting smacked around by Villa at the weekend, I was even more confident. And it was, even when we went 1-0 down, I thought, we're not out of this. We will score at least one goal. And I've obviously not thought that about my club for quite a while over the last couple of years. So performances were brilliant. We were missing Jullington, we were missing Saint-Maximin, still, you know, Trippier and a few others out of the squad, so we were nowhere near our strongest lineup. But Bruno Guimaraes came in and managed to score probably the sexiest goal he'll ever score in his career on his first start for us and win the game. So
what a goal it was!
Oh, it was a ridiculous goal. And Dan Byrne with the header down as well. He was colossal again. He's been absolutely fantastic since he came in. And it was absolutely nailed on that two of the January signings would score the goal, score the goals that would win us the game, because Hasenhüttl has been moaning since November that these players shouldn't be able to play, and is it fair, and blah blah blah, and oh, you manufactured a postponement so your squad could be stronger in the return game, and that's not really the case. It's just, I think, a few people got COVID, which they tend to do in a global pandemic. So It was always going to happen like that. It was always going to be Sod's Law. And I even had money on Chris Wood scoring last night, and that paid off quite nicely, because I was like, as soon as he's starting the game against Wingy Hasenhüttl, this is happening. And John Joe Shelby dropped a superb ball onto his head for the equaliser, and happy days.
10 points clear of the relegation zone now, and amazingly, only 14 points below European places as well. So it just goes to show how things have turned around for Newcastle. On to Wolves versus Watford. I called this as a 1-0 to Wolverhampton Wanderers. They managed to complete that within 13 minutes. The game finished 4-0, Niall.
Yeah, it did. And you called a 1-0 win for Wolverhampton Wanderers over Watford, but you also said this yesterday.
They shouldn't worry about Watford because Watford are absolutely awful.
The prophet.
I mean,
the
it's prophet, hardly Nostradamus, is it?
No, it's not. But like London buses, you predicted Chelsea will be fine and will galvanise against Norwich. They did. And you predicted that Watford are absolutely awful, and they were. As you say, they were 3-0 down.
Massive shout to them, to be fair.
He's done really, really well. I mean, will he make it a hat-trick?
Really better than his neck out.
Better than his, who knows, wins predictions anyway, but we'll get onto that a little bit later. Yeah, I mean, Watford are going down, aren't they? I mean, on that display yesterday. I think Roy Hodgson, it was a thankless task. I mean, he's mid-70s. He hadn't been tapped up by anyone since leaving Crystal Palace. Everyone thought that he was basically unofficially retired. Watford come calling. It's a win-win situation for Roy Hodgson. If he doesn't keep them up, everyone says, oh, well, they're a bit of a crazy club that changes managers all the time and they were always going to struggle. And if he does keep them up, then, you know, Roy's a genius. What a way to end his career. I don't think it impacts him whatsoever in terms of his reputation as a manager, his legacy, what he's achieved in the game over the 40 years or whatever it is that he's been a football manager. So I think Ben Foster was to blame last night. Someone so experienced between the sticks for Watford, you'd think would be able to perform a little bit better than he did. You know, his distribution was poor. He was at fault for at least one of the goals, if not two. So I don't think it helps when your goalkeeper's throwing the ball to an opponent in a match where you basically have to win. So yeah, Watford weren't very good last night. When Roy Hodgson first came in, I think they steadied the ship. The first game was a 0-0, and then they lost 1-0, and then 2, and then 3. And now they're just gradually conceding more and more and more. So for Wolves to be able to score that many goals from a side who haven't scored that regularly this season, they've been tight at the back and they tend to edge games out, like you say, I think that was more of a marker of how poor Watford have been recently rather than how good Wolves are. But that being said, there were a number of excellent goals on display last night. You've mentioned Bruno Guimaraes' effort. I'm sure we'll come on to one of the goals in the Aston Villa game, but beautiful chipped effort from Ruben Neves to loft it over Foster and into the far corner. That was an excellent goal, and we were treated to some really nice strikes last night.
Great goal that a goalkeeper like Foster shouldn't be conceded, because he stood 5 yards out from his goal, wasn't he?
He's like, well, listen, I like Ben Foster. I know he's trying to build a bit of a profile for himself outside of the game. He's got his YouTube channel where he sticks the GoPro in goal, and the Watford fans are starting to get a bit annoyed at it because obviously he's rattling in goals every week, you know, in terms of conceding.
He's got so many memory cards on the go right now. It's mental.
But I mean, I can understand why the Watford fans would be annoyed, but I mean, it's quite clear that Ben Foster knows that his career is coming to an end. So yeah, I mean, that'll be disappointing for Watford, but not anything that Jim didn't predict yesterday with his wise words on the Hornets.
Let's talk about that Aston Villa game. They couldn't quite match Wolves. They only managed the 3 goals against Leeds United, whose hopes of a new start under their new manager haven't lasted very long, Marley.
No, not at all. I think the performance I mentioned yesterday, the performance at the weekend against Leicester was pretty good. You know, something certainly to build on. And Jesse Marsh said before this game, you know, we've got a plan for Coutinho. We've got something to shut him down, and we know what to expect. And 22 minutes into the game, Coutinho slams in the opener, and you're thinking, right, now what? Because now it's about scoring goals, and you have to score. At that point, you have to score at least 2 to win the game, and Leeds haven't done that for a little while. I think they haven't won a game since they beat West Ham down at London Stadium 3-2 when Jack Harrison scored that hat-trick. And other than sort of, well, there just wasn't, it wasn't much from Leeds. There wasn't much to shout about. They had 2 shots in the entire game. One was Bamford ballooning one that landed on the motorway that runs past Leeds Stadium. it was just like, it looked like relegation.
Their defense is awful, Marley. Honestly, it's shocking.
It is, yeah. I mean, you can go back to the injuries as well, but you still hope that even your third and fourth choice centre backs are better than what they are, because, you know, Strouk, I mean, he's got, the guy's got lovely hair, but he's a terrible defender. I mean,
He's like, I mean, Ayling got done for the first goal.
Yeah.
Strike got the deflection as well off of him.
Yeah.
And Firpo was just all over the place.
Firpo's defending for Cash's goal is ridiculous. Like, how are you letting Cash come inside there? It's the only touch you can take if you watch the goal back, you know. You can see what's going to happen before Cash even does it. And then even the finish is poor, really, because Meslier should save it. But you feel sorry for Meslier, Christ. He's like that meme off Lord of the Rings where, you know, the guy's got his sword and the entire army's coming towards against him. That is being Leeds. That is Leeds' goalkeeping situation right now. And it doesn't take long. This is the thing Leeds are really facing as well. It does not take long for the fan base to then turn around and go, why did we get rid of Bielsa? Because he was so loved that, you know, a couple of bad results and people are like, we should never have got rid of him. This guy's crap. Americans have never done it in the Premier League, and the slightly xenophobic like attitude that comes with that as well. And that's happening. You've seen it last night all over Twitter. How the hell do we get rid of Bielsa for this guy? He's unproven. He's done this and that. Our defence is still bad. We're still playing rubbish. Man for man might not have worked, but neither's his philosophy of this. And Leeds are banging trouble, because the only way Leeds stay up is if Burnley lose all the games from now to the end of the season. And as we know with Burnley, they are like Japanese knotweed. They do not go away. They get stronger as the season goes on, and they might just eke out some wins. And you'd fancy them if they win two games. Will Leeds win? You know, will Leeds pick up another 3 or 4 points to get back above them in that fight? And I'm not sure they can, playing like this, unless Phillips and Cooper and Llorente come back and really improve them.
24 goals conceded in the last 8 games. That's an average of 3 a game, which is ridiculous over a run like that.
How many is it this season? More than 60 now, isn't it, they've conceded?
It's a lot. I don't mean, it's like 24 and 8, so
I remember when Eddie Howe got relegated as the Bournemouth manager, and they had conceded, I think, 58 goals one season and 60 in the other. And everyone was saying, you can't stay up in the Premier League if you've conceded 60 goals in a season. It's March the 11th. They've already conceded more than 60 goals. It's a real problem.
Banging trouble, Leeds United. As for West Ham, they had a disappointing result last night in Sevilla. I'm going to take this one. There's not a huge amount to say, I don't think. It was kind of as expected. Sevilla were just the better team. They scored a great goal. West Ham will consider themselves lucky to come away with just a 1-0 loss for the home leg, and probably lucky as well that away goals have been abolished this season. But we really missed Jared Bowen. He was a massive miss. Fornells was incredibly wasteful with possession. Vlasic, here's another thing I called, actually, because Vlasic had his chance. He played the full game, missed an absolute sitter. And that was the West Ham's best chance of the game he missed. So I don't think West Ham's will be too disappointed. I'm disappointed in West Ham fans for the trouble that was in Sevilla ahead of the game, which again was kind of predictable, but very sad to see. But with a 1-0 loss, taking it back to the London Stadium, West Ham still very much in the Europa League. As for the Europa League conference, that was Leicester versus Rennes. Niall, your views on this? Did you watch it? Were you aware of it?
Well, actually, the game I did take in the most was the one that Marley's just discussed, Leeds against Aston Villa. And, you know, we've obviously already boxed that one off. But I did catch a little bit of this game, Leicester versus Rennes. And it was a cagey game to start with. I think both sides were quite aggressive in terms of trying to figure each other out. And in the end, Leicester ended up shining through in terms of quality, and that's something that we touched upon yesterday as well. Rennes are in a good run of form in Ligue 1 in France. I think they'd won 4 of their previous 5 league games before this trip to Leicester City, but King Power Stadium is generally quite a good hunting ground for Leicester. At least it has been in European competition. If I think back to their European matches this season, the first game of the campaign was a 2-2 draw with Napoli. Napoli could well be in with a shout of winning the Italian title this season. So that's no shabby result at all. They were 2-0 up in that game as well and drew 2-2. Patson Dak has been excellent in Europe this season. And the other games that Leicester had on home soil, including the recent one in the conference against Randers, They've run away with it, really. They've been the better side. So home advantage was definitely at play last night, and I think that that's a benefit. The only problem is with Leicester is we know they can be a bit shaky at the back. So if things get a bit dicey in the second leg away at Rennes, and maybe the French score a goal early to make it 2-1 on aggregate, and then they get another, I think that is when you might want to start worrying about things as a Leicester fan. But 2-0 is a very comfortable scoreline. And as we suggested, Leicester, despite the fact they're 12th, 13th in the Premier League table at the moment, should be too strong for the French club. Looking at the teams that are in the Conference League, Leicester should go all the way, really. They'll be disappointed if they don't reach at least the final. But they're in a good spot to do so. So yeah, a good victory for them last night, and we await the second leg in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, if they get through this, it's Roma, isn't it? That's the potential banana skin. But other than that, you'd fancy them to win most of the games against other opposition left in the Europa Conference. Well, that was it. Double quick time. Stop the clock. I like that. We should do that again. A rattle through of last night's games. We're going to look ahead next, though, and give you details of how you might be able to get your hand on £6,000. That'd be a decent start to your weekend, wouldn't it? We'll talk about it next on Football Social Daily.
Football's Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode. Football's Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Welcome back to Football Social Daily. The final bit of today's podcast is looking ahead to the weekend's Premier League action with Who Knows Wins, the betting game where you can take on your mates rather than the bookies. Over £2 million won on the app, which you can download now from the Play Store or the App Store. There's guaranteed winners every day, and all you need to do is pick the winners from the options available within the app. The one that we all play every single week is the Pick 10, which is 10 fixtures from the Saturday games. You pick your wins, your draws, or your losses, and you win a share of the jackpot. £5 in, but you can win £6,000 as a jackpot if you get all 10 right and the only person to do so, and then it kind of cascades down beyond that. Some of us have even won a little bit of cash here and there so far playing for the last 3 weeks. I'm not one of them, but there is £10,000 in the prize pot this weekend to be shared amongst the winners. And we've picked three games that we're going to do a quick preview of now and tell you who we're going for in terms of the results here. So the first one I've gone for is Manchester United versus Tottenham, which I think is probably the most enticing tie of the whole Premier League weekend. But who's the informed team here, Marley? Is it one of those really tough to call games, or do you think there's a clear winner out of this one?
I think this is really tough to call, to be honest, because, you know, both teams are at the best probably as good as each other, but both teams haven't showed the best enough this season. You know, they're very sort of erratic and up and down, and you remember the couple of years ago with Mourinho coming to Old Trafford with Spurs and smashing Man U 6-1, and you know, they're capable of results like that, and Man United are capable of capitulating as well as turning the team over. But I think this one's really tight, and even though, like, my logic suggests like that it should be a draw, I wouldn't be surprised with Man United's defence and Spurs coming off the back of a decent performance that Spurs would win this. So with that said, I mean, I'd probably just back a slight Spurs win, like a 2-1 or a 3-2. Mm-hmm.
I've backed a Spurs win in this one, Niall, but the thing that's nagging away at the back of my head is that Derby Day loss, the humiliation that Manchester United had against Man City. And would you expect some kind of reaction from that Manchester United team? I mean, it's been levelled at them several times this season. They don't care. So will they have that reaction to the humbling they had against the noisy neighbours?
Well, you'd like to think so, particularly with the game being at Old Trafford. I think the thing for me is exactly that. At the Theatre of Dreams this season, it's not exactly been straightforward for Manchester United. There have been too many lacklustre results. A recent goalless draw against Watford there was a poor result. A draw against Southampton at home was not a great result. They lost to Wolves at home as well, didn't they, recently? So, you know, they're not excellent results, really. Albeit Ralf Rangnick has kept things quite tight. United haven't lost too many games under Rangnick, but they also haven't won too many. They've kind of been here and there, and they've not been consistent enough. And that's why only 26% of people, despite the fact that games at Old Trafford, have chosen Manchester United to win against Tottenham. But that being said, the reverse fixture before Christmas, Tottenham were terrible. They were absolutely shocking. They got beat 3-0. Ronaldo scored a really good volley. Whether he'll be back in the fold this weekend remains to be seen, because he missed the Manchester derby with a hip flexor injury. He's been over in Portugal rehabilitating that. Whether he'll be back involved in the squad, we just don't know at this moment in time of recording this podcast. But like I say, Tottenham were shocking in that game. Marcus Rashford had the freedom of Tottenham Hotspur Stadium and scored a third goal. It was far too simple for Manchester United on that occasion. But that's the thing. I think we find here with this fixture, obviously massive top four implications. United can't afford to lose to Tottenham, really, and vice versa, because both of these sides are gunning for the top four, and there's only one fourth spot available, and currently Arsenal are in pole position for that. So this is a really fascinating game in terms of the race for Champions League football next season. But you have here two inconsistent sides. You've got a Tottenham side that can beat Manchester City and perform unbelievably well, and then go and lose to Burnley, and then lose 3-2 to Southampton after being well in the game. So it is really difficult to call this one, I find. But hopefully it shapes up to be a good game. I think the smart money's on the draw here. That's where 30% of people have gone. And I find it hard to split these two. So I'll be going for the draw.
So draw for Marley and for me and... Sorry, draw for Niall and for me and Marley. We've gone for the Spurs win on that one. So next fixture, Everton versus Wolves, I've picked for this one. Marley, what can Everton learn from Wolves when they look at that club in terms of how you can use a cash injection from a wealthy owner to kind of level up the football club and put some blueprints down when Everton are in a not dissimilar situation and it just seems to have gone horribly wrong for them? So what can they take away from Wolves and their strategy?
I think something that every club can take from Wolves is their solid plan. Their plan was, probably
having one.
that is the crux of it. Wolves have a plan and Everton don't have a plan. Everton's plan has always been spend a load of money and hope we get up the league table, like a kind of an arrogance of if we spend more money than everyone else we'll get up the table, and it simply doesn't work like that. It's why clever businessmen don't get involved in football, because you've got to spend a hell of a lot of money to on something where the chance of winning something is so slim that it makes absolutely no sense to do it. So Wolves have seen that. Wolves know that. And if you go back 5 or 6 years when they're in the Championship and not really looking like coming up, they had the plan to make Wolves mini Portugal, and to use an agent's influence on the game to sign better players. And if you go back, signing Neves, Moutinho, Jimenez, all players out of George Mendes' little black book. Some people can say it's not very sort of fair that they're using that relationship, but there's nothing wrong with it, and there's nothing in the rules that says you can't do that. So it's a classic case of thinking outside the box. People forget Wolves have got one of the richest men in the world, richest groups in the world, financing them. I think it's a Chinese pharmaceutical company. They've got more money... I think they've got more money than Man City, or they've got maybe Man City and Newcastle are the only clubs that have got more money than them, but they've got money and a plan, whereas Everton have just got money and a crazy bloke in charge who wants to spend $500 million on a club, and not really take his chances, basically try and take his chances, but obviously it isn't working like that. And if you come down to the game tomorrow, Wolves don't concede many, Everton don't score many. So it's going to be a tough game for Everton. But at the same time, it's clubs like Wolves that you can't go into this game thinking, oh, we'll be lucky to get something there. You've got to go into this, they've got to go into every game now, Everton, thinking we need this 3 points. We've got really, really hard games coming up. Wolves aren't quite as good as everybody else in this running. So we need these points now, and they have to pick up something quick, because as we were saying the other day on the podcast, it's time, it's panic stations for Everton. It's all hands to the pump, and to get themselves out of this stuff, because they had a horrendous result on Monday night and they need to bounce back from that quickly.
Positive news for Everton is that Dominic Calvert-Lewin is fit again. He did play on Monday. He wasn't massively impressive on Monday, but then he's been out for such a long time. It takes players to get back to full game pace, but he has returned for Everton. Can he make enough of a difference between now and the end of the season to get those results for Everton? Is he the missing piece of the puzzle that they need?
Oh, it's a tough one. Like you say, he's been out for ages. He's pretty much been invisible this season just purely because of that injury, whereas last season he was someone who forced his way into the England team. I think he's really good in the air. I think he's excellent in the box. I think he's got so many good attributes that could make him a top striker in the Premier League. But he's not playing for a top club at the moment. He's playing for a club that are in disarray. Everton were dire against Tottenham. They just looked like, as you say, they lacked a plan. Lampard really needs to pick them up and dust them down. Whether Calvert-Lewin starts, I don't know, but they need to get something. And, you know, Goodison Park as well, I think that's the key. This is one of 8 games left this season at Goodison Park. That has to be the difference for Everton. They have to make Goodison Park as tough as possible for visiting sides. We know Wolves are a really difficult nut to crack. Only the top 3 in the Premier League at the moment, Liverpool, Chelsea and Manchester City, have a tighter defence than Wolves. So they're going to need something. They're going to need Calvert-Lewin to hit the straps soon and not, you know, kind of take some time to get back into a stride after injury. They can't afford to, because, you know, if they keep playing like this, they are going to be banging a relegation fight. They already are. And I think that at the moment, Everton are lucky that Leeds look worse than them, Watford and Norwich look worse than them. You know, and Burnley have got a couple of games in hand, but we know, as Marley says, sometimes they can pull a result out of nowhere. Everton need to start winning games at home. It's as simple as that. They've got more home games than away. When the fans at Goodison Park are bouncing and they can get behind the team, they can be a differing factor. They can be a difference maker. Obviously, trying to stay upbeat and confident and enthusiastic when your side are getting panned every week is not easy. I think the fans understand Lampard. I think the fans wanted Lampard maybe more than some of the other candidates that were available. It was never going to work with Rafa Benitez. I think we knew that. It was crying out for a change. I'm not surprised that Benitez got sacked, but there's no honeymoon period for Frank Lampard. I think he won a couple of cup games, but so what? They need to stay up in the Premier League, and it's going to be a real tough test against Wolverhampton Wanderers, but they just have to find something. You know, they have to look around at each other in the dressing room, as teammates, and think, are you up for this? Have you got what it takes? Because there are players in that dressing room who have got something to prove. Some of the young players like Calvert-Lewin trying to get back in the England team. There are others that do have something to prove, but, you know, it doesn't really matter. Like Van der Beek, for example. If he goes down with Everton, it's okay. Just go back to United because he's on loan. Andros Townsend, he's played in the Championship before. You know, we're talking about players here that have they got the guts to stand up and keep Everton in the Premier League. That's what we need to see, and that's what Lampard needs to instill in those players. And if he can do that against Wolves this weekend and Everton can pick up a win, then I think that they should be all right. But if they lose, then it's looking grim for them. I think this is a tough one. I think a point will be enough for Everton this weekend, I think, just to kind of give them a bit of something, a bit of respite, because anything will be better than that drubbing they suffered to Spurs.
23% of people on the Who Knows Wins app are very optimistic that Everton can get something out of this. They've gone for the win. I haven't. I've gone for a relatively easy Wolves victory. So you're going for the draw, are you, Niall?
I think so. I just think that I can't see Everton. We know Wolves' defence is tight and Everton haven't scored that many goals recently, so I think that the draw would be the sensible choice.
And Marley, what are you going for?
Because it's at Goodison, I'm going for a draw. I think if it was at Molineux, they would have a chance, but yeah, goalless draw probably.
Final game we're going to look at is Leeds versus Norwich. Man, this is a big game for Leeds United. I mean, if they don't win this, Marley, if they don't manage to score a few past Norwich and get 3 points, is that it? Is that give up, go home, pack your bags?
Yeah, could be. Marsh might be on the first plane back over the Atlantic, I think. He's not... I mean, you can't ask for an easier game, could you? You couldn't, like you're saying with Chelsea before, if you're in crisis, you need to play Norwich, because they've slacked off a lot. Started off well under Dean Smith. They have receded to a point where they're just too easy to beat, too easy to play against. There's not enough fight or aggression or quality in that squad. Leeds do have a little bit of quality. You know, Rafinha has been pretty poor this season, to be fair, but he's still got that level where if he can hit his top form, he can destroy most teams in the league, if we're being honest. So he shouldn't really have too much problems against Norwich if he turns up, but he hasn't turned up much this season so far. So, in terms of the sort of game, this is huge for Leeds. If they lose now, that atmosphere will be horrendous. It will be absolutely toxic at the club, and it'll all be doom and gloom even more than it is, and even more than it has been over the last 3 or 4 months, because You know, they need to get something. Will they get something? I'm not sure. I've seen enough from Leeds to say, you know what, I'm confident you're going to score and keep Norwich out at the other side. But having seen Norwich against Brentford, who were a similar sort of level team last week, and go down, you know, without a fight, you never know. So I think it's quite a tough one to predict, to be fair. But if I have to go for something, I'd probably go for a very narrow Leeds win.
I mean, part of the problem with these two teams is they do lack a little bit of depth in terms of the quality they have. And I was looking at Leeds and Norwich's squad, Niall, and thinking, who would you pick off from these teams? If they both got relegated, who would you go in and pick up? And you got Rafinha and Calvin Phillips at Leeds United. Previously at Norwich, I would have said Max Ahrens, but he's not really been at the races this season. Is that kind of the problem? Is that when you look at the two teams, there just isn't enough quality for the Premier League in there?
Yep. That's exactly it. That is exactly it. You've got two sides here coming up against each other, both of whom have conceded the most goals in the Premier League this season. Norwich have conceded 61 and Leeds have conceded 64. Two terrible defences. Two defences that I think would probably concede a few in the Championship if they carry on playing like this. I think that's the difference. I think Leeds are better going forward. They've scored more goals this season. Norwich have only scored 17, the fewest of any side in the Premier League, whereas Leeds have scored 29 in their games so far this campaign. So with Bamford coming back from injury, missed a good chance against Aston Villa last night. I think he could be perhaps the difference maker. Calvin Phillips has obviously been a huge blow, but I think we're beyond the point now where you can blame injuries on Leeds United's form. I think that moment has passed. They've had enough with players out of the team to be able to maybe try and just establish some sort of rhythm without those players in the side. They haven't been able to do it, and there is a distinct lack of quality there. But I'd say that on paper, Norwich have a worse side than Leeds United do, and you're right. I don't think there'd be too many people picking off Norwich's players. Obviously, we knew that Daniel Farke, when he was the manager of Norwich, was capable of galvanising them in the Championship and bringing them back up. Will Dean Smith do that? I'm not sure. We'll wait and see. He's obviously done it before with Aston Villa. He's managed Brentford in the Championship, so he knows the level well. For Leeds United, it's a must-win, isn't it? Like, they have to win, like you said a minute ago. If they don't win this game against Norwich, then the despair will spiral into overdrive. And Jesse Marsh, as Marley says, will get some serious scrutiny. Although, I don't think it's too much his problem. I just don't think the players are good enough. I think they were probably batting above their station for a long time, Leeds United. If you look at the side that finished, I'm not sure where they finished last season. Was it 11th or something? The side that finished comfortably mid-table in the Premier League last season. If you look at the squad and the players they had, there's no way they should have finished there. So it's a massive overachievement. And some might say that's testament to Bielsa and the extra juicy squeezes out of the players with the methods. But he's gone. And I always worried for Leeds when Bielsa left. I've said this on the podcast a number of times. If he gets sacked or walked away, everything revolves around Marcelo Bielsa. It was Marcelo Bielsa's club. You know, he was almost more famous than the players, and more focus was put on him than the players. Well, now it's all down to the players, because people aren't going to be looking at Jesse Marsh as the messiah. He's a good coach and he's proven that in Salzburg, and he's come through a good system in the Red Bull system. But is he good enough to keep Leeds up with the players that he's got? Is he good enough to improve the players that Leeds have got and make them better? I'm not so sure. So I think, much like what I said about Everton, it's on these Leeds players to just dig deep and find something. Because if they keep conceding goals at the rate they're conceding, they do so against Norwich and they get beat at the weekend, I really do think that they could be in the bottom three come the end of the season.
Who's the winning? Who's winning this one? And let me say that in a way that makes sense. Who do you think will win?
It's at Elland Road, right? So
yeah,
I think Leeds have to win. I think Leeds will win. I think Bamford back, it'd be a different. If he starts, he played half an hour off the bench against Villa. If Bamford starts, Leeds win.
I think Leeds will win. I think it's been so long for Norwich since they last picked up a victory, they've forgotten how to. So I think Leeds will just about edge this one. Right, there are our picks for Who Knows Wins. If you want to join us in the Pick 10 League or any of the other games that are available, you can get the app. You can get it for free in the App Store or in Google Play. $6,000 up for grabs for the jackpot winner in the Pick 10 League. But there is loads of different games and loads of money you can win from your mates. Go head to head, take them on, rather than taking on the bookies. But that is it for today's Football Social Daily. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you on the other side.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.